Hello again, everyone, wherever you may be, and welcome to the 144th edition of KHOI Community Radio's Capital Week, your window on the world of Iowa politics, where we explore and analyze who's been making news in and around the state capital, what that news is, and what it all means. I'm Dennis Hart, joined as always by my partner in politics, Laura Bellin of the blog site Bleeding Heartland. Welcome, Laura.
Good to be here, Dennis.
Laura, as usual, we have plenty to talk about, including a new Des Moines Register Iowa poll that came out today, Monday, that shows, well, we'll tell you what it shows. And we're also going to hash out the vote last week for Speaker in the U.S. House of Representatives and how Iowa's four House members voted. But first, we start with the Iowa reaction to the ongoing battle between Israel and Hamas. Laura, hundreds of Grinnell College students staged a walkout last week to express solidarity with Palestine and demand that the college stop any financial support of Israel. Now, this has been happening at campuses across the country. There has been blowback across the country. And yes, Laura, there was blowback in Iowa.
Yes, this was part of a day of demonstrations that was called by the Palestinian Youth Movement. And as you mentioned, many college campuses had similar walkouts and similar slogans, Free Palestine, and anti-Zionist slogans, anti-Israel slogans. And as we are starting to see, Republican politicians, both at the federal level and now at the state level, are starting to call for reprisals, basically, against universities that tolerate this kind of protest against Israel.
Iowa Republican State House member Austin Harris posted on X, also known as Twitter, that colleges that give harbor to anti-Semitic organizations should not receive a single penny in taxpayer dollars. He was not alone in saying that.
Yes, and I asked him, I sought clarification on how he would define that, because the First Amendment, it bars the government from engaging in viewpoint-based discrimination. And so I think it would be fairly difficult to craft a bill that says that the state funding or federal funding will be withdrawn from colleges and universities that have what he may call anti-Semitic organizations on campus. I mean, that seems like it could wade into viewpoint-based discrimination territory pretty quickly. He did not respond to my question about that.
Meanwhile, Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst helped lead a group of senators in demanding that the Federal Education Department ensure Jewish and Israeli students are not subject to discrimination.
Yes, that's right. And I'm not sure where those ideas are going to go in the Senate. Several of the presidential candidates, and I think we'll get to this in a minute, several of the presidential candidates also want to see the federal government doing more to try to get colleges to crack down on this kind of behavior and expression.
And Iowa Republican 2nd Congressional District incumbent Ashley Hinson joined 34 other Republicans in a letter calling on the Federal Justice Department to investigate pro-Hamas groups and protect Jewish communities from a surge in what they're calling anti-Semitic threats.
Yes, well, the Anti-Defamation League found that the number of anti-Semitic incidents has skyrocketed since October 7th, which is when the Hamas attacks occurred in Israel. Also, there has been an uptick in anti-Islamic attacks as well. So these things are happening on a parallel track. But what we see, or at least what we hear from politicians and elected officials, is mainly concern about one side of that.
And the presidential candidates, the Republican candidates, they have competed with each other, really, to see who could promise the harshest crackdowns on pro-Palestinian protesters at American universities.
That's right. So Donald Trump said that he would revoke the visas of students or that he called anti-American and anti-Semitic. Again, I think that would be fairly difficult to craft something, a policy on that. Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, also said that he would cancel the visas of what he called pro-Palestine students. Nikki Haley has said, I think at least she was the first I heard calling for this, to cut or condition government funding to higher education on the universities not allowing these kinds of protests. And Tim Scott, a senator from South Carolina, said that he would revoke Pell Grant funding for universities that don't sufficiently condemn terrorism. Again, I think that would be fairly difficult. That would be basically like the government compelling speech by a university. And I think it's easy to talk about this as a policy in the abstract, but to craft something that would survive scrutiny, I think would be difficult.
All right, on to the U.S. House of Representatives. And it was another wild week last week, but the Republicans did elect a Speaker of the House 3 weeks after they had deposed former Republican Speaker Kevin McCarthy, the new Speaker, Laura, Mike Johnson of Louisiana.
Yes, and someone who a few weeks ago would say a lot of people were not familiar with, even people who follow congressional news very closely. He is by far the least senior person ever to serve as Speaker of the House. He has never chaired a committee. I don't believe he's chaired a subcommittee. He doesn't really have a leadership role. And his staff is also relatively unseasoned. So, but he did get unanimous support. I think that the House Republican caucus, they were just exhausted by this. And he seemed to satisfy the different factions of the party and also Donald Trump.
Yeah, and every Republican, as you said, in the House voted for him, including all four of Iowa's Republican House members.
Yes, and I think that one thing we learned from this is that the differences in the House Republican caucus are not so much policy related or ideological as personal. I mean, there's not a lot of difference between Mike Johnson of Louisiana and Jim Jordan of Ohio. They were both very involved in efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election. They both have a position on basically supporting a total abortion ban. And so some of the Republicans they had given various reasons for opposing Jim Jordan, but then they turned around and supported Mike Johnson instead.
As you said, former President Trump supported Mike Johnson. He also doomed the candidacy of Tom Emmer of Minnesota, who had come forward for a moment or two and said he would run for speaker, but Trump buried him on Truth Social.
Yeah, I mean, this has been the whole experience of the last 3 weeks before the election of Mike Johnson. It was really extraordinary because normally, well, first of all, the speaker had never been ousted before in U.S. history. But normally when the House Speaker would step down or leave for whatever reason, the person next in line would step up. So Steve Scalise, the House Majority Leader, would have been presumed to be the next in line. He was vetoed basically by the Trump faction in the House Republican caucus. Then Jim Jordan didn't get it. And Tom Emmer, he was the third ranking person in the caucus, the House Majority Whip, really, again, next in line, you would think that he would be broadly satisfactory. I didn't see a lot of people. In fact, Matt Gaetz, who was one of the people who ousted Kevin McCarthy, he had expressed support for Tom Emmer. But then as soon as Donald Trump came out on his social platform and said, no, you know, this guy's a rhino and he's terrible, then Matt Gaetz withdrew his support. And so Tom Emmer never even put it to a vote of the House.
Right. And because all four Iowa Congress people voted for Mike Johnson, you would anticipate, and it would be true, that they all had congratulatory and very happy remarks about his election.
They did. I mean, Marionette Miller makes this interesting. She really glossed over the fact that she did not support Jim Jordan on that second and third ballot. I noticed that in the statement that they provided to the media, but also in the statement that she posted on YouTube and in her email newsletter that went out on Sunday, she didn't really talk about that part of the drama. She just said that she thinks that Mike Johnson is going to unite the caucus and this is going to be great. Ashley Hinson also appraised Johnson as a constitutional conservative, which, you know, I think many people would take issue with since the Constitution would call for the person who won the presidential election to be inaugurated.
And said the same thing. It's time to get back to the people's work. And Randy Feenstra said, again, he's a strong conservative. So now the people's work includes, we would think, in the next 3 weeks, which is how much time they have left, they have to avoid somehow a partial government shutdown. Can they do it is the question.
Well, everything that I'm reading from the congressional reporters is that the House Republicans are willing to give Mike Johnson a lot more leeway than Kevin McCarthy. And they feel that Mike Johnson has already basically told the caucus, we are not going to be able to pass several single subject budget bills and get these enacted into law by November 17th. So we're going to have to do another continuing spending resolution. And I think that he wants it to go into January instead of expiring around Christmas or New Year's. He doesn't want to get jammed up during the holiday season. But it sounds like that some of the people who use that basically as their pretext for getting rid of Kevin McCarthy are going to be fine with Mike Johnson cutting some kind of a deal.
We will see. All right, now it's time for our theme song for Capital Week Caucus Almanac. Oh, that's right. I keep forgetting we don't have a theme song. We'll have to get one.
Not yet.
The new word today, this morning, early this morning, before we were even up, the new Des Moines Register Iowa poll was put out showing, well, what does it show? Donald Trump with a giant lead among likely Iowa Republican caucus goers in January. That is really not a surprise, Laura, because it's been this way all year.
It has. And ironically, this is a poll by Seltzer & Co. She's been the pollster for the Des Moines Register for several decades. Trump is at 43%. That's 1 point higher than in the last poll that Seltzer conducted among Iowa Republican caucus goers in August. And it's a large lead over the candidates who are tied for second place, Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley. But it's actually low compared to some other Iowa polls that have been in the field. Many Iowa polls have shown Trump above 50%. So you could look at this and say, oh, well, you know, Trump is only at 43%. That's not that high. But when you dig into the numbers, Trump supporters are far more likely to say they're very enthusiastic. They're more likely to say they're locked in and not open to changing their minds. And it really looks like an unassailable lead to me.
Let's be specific. He has 43%. DeSantis and Haley have 16%. That's a drop of 3 points for DeSantis and a 10-point hike for Nikki Haley. So now it's a race for second place between DeSantis and Haley, a battle to the finish.
Yes, I think that this poll is really the worst case scenario for Ron DeSantis, because he's been a clear second place candidate for most of the year. And what he was looking to do, of course, was narrow the gap between him and Donald Trump. That didn't happen. And he wanted to extend the gap between him and the rest of the field. And that didn't happen, because Nikki Haley has carved out a position where she's gained a lot among suburban voters. She's gained a lot among independents. I think one reason we might see Trump's support in this poll lower than in some of the other polls is that about 20% of the sample are independents who say they plan to attend the Republican caucuses. And remember, the Iowa caucuses, you can go change your registration on caucus night. Anybody can show up and decide to participate in a Republican caucus. And the independents who right now, I mean, they don't have any, nothing's happening on the Democratic side, right? So if they participate at all, it would be on the Republican side. And we know that Trump is much more popular among Republicans than he is among independents.
So the other numbers on this latest Iowa poll, Tim Scott at 7%, Vivek Ramaswamy and Chris Christie, 4%, Mike Pence, who dropped out on Saturday, we'll talk about that in a minute, 2%, Asa Hutchinson, 1%, and Ryan Binkley. Ryan Binkley, the $3 million man who has spent more money in Iowa than anyone else during the caucus, he has 0%, zero.
0%. Well, I mean, it's a bad poll for Tim Scott. He dropped from 9% to 7%. He clearly, again, Nikki Haley leapfrogged him in this. He is being actively considered by a smaller number of people. And I thought it was quite amazing that Vivek Ramaswamy, who's been campaigning here a lot and has spent a lot of time in Iowa and done a lot of events, is tied at 4% with Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey, who literally has not set foot in Iowa this year. I mean, 4% is a lot better than Chris Christie did in the 2016 caucuses. And he actually campaigned here in 2015. So, I mean, it's interesting. I think that 4%, you can consider that a sort of, you know, anti-Trump proxy, because Chris Christie seems to be preferred by people who don't like Donald Trump at this point. But I mean, I thought that was a pretty bad number for Vivek Ramaswamy, frankly.
So that's the latest Iowa poll. The latest average of national polling shows Trump burying his GOP opponents. As of last Thursday, Trump has 57% nationally, DeSantis 15%, Haley 8%. Again, you and I have talked about this for a long time. I don't see at this moment, nor have I seen for months, any avenue for any other candidates to really come after Trump.
No, I think everybody at this point, everybody else in the field, is positioning themselves for 2028, or in some cases, possibly positioning themselves for something in the next Republican administration, although that presumably would not be either Ron DeSantis or Nikki Haley, because the bad blood between the DeSantis and the Trump camps seems to be increasing. Donald Trump loves disparaging DeSantis. His campaign loves putting out statements calling attention to the DeSantis campaign's problems. And to a lesser extent, Trump also seems to be showing some contempt for Nikki Haley.
So outside groups have spent millions of dollars against Trump in the last months to almost no effect nationally.
Yeah, definitely to no effect nationally. I mean, I've been looking at this, the money that's been spent in Iowa. There was a group called Win It Back, which is affiliated with the Club for Growth. They spent $4 million on Iowa TV ads in three markets, Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, and Sioux City, in July and August. They had six different ads. They were very professionally done. They all featured people who said they voted for Trump twice and are not supporting him this time. And I mean, you could argue that maybe they moved the needle a little, because he is polling at a lower level in Iowa than he is nationally. But I mean, the groups like the Americans for Prosperity have done direct mail piece after direct mail piece attacking Trump. There are also some lesser known groups that have done direct mail attacking Trump. And it just doesn't seem to be having any effect. If it did lower his support at all in the summer, nothing has changed basically since August. So it is, I mean, the Republican primary and caucus going electorate broadly supports Donald Trump and isn't really looking for an alternative to Trump. And I think that even something that is well produced and trying to appeal that is tailored to that demographic, they're just finding that there just isn't fertile ground to work with here.
It is 15 minutes and 40 seconds after the hour, wherever you're listening. And this is KHOI's Capital Week with Laura Bellin and me, Dennis Hart, your one-stop source for everything political going on in Iowa. We are here every week at this time to talk about what's been happening in and around the state capitol and what it all means. Let's briefly go through the rest of the caucus news because we have other news than that. Mr. Trump appeared in Sioux City yesterday on Sunday for the eighth time in Iowa in the past month. He mistakenly called Sioux City Sioux Falls, an easy mistake to make because they're only 80 miles apart. But he railed against his GOP rivals. He had called him desanctimonious. He called Nikki Haley bird brain. It was the typical Donald Trump stuff.
It was. And I've been watching these rallies on C-SPAN. And I'm finding that watching the speakers who come on stage before Donald Trump is in some ways even more interesting than watching the former president's remarks. But this Trump campaign is so different from the 2015 campaign in terms of organization. They have the reporters who were there on the ground. They've got campaign staff scouring the area, asking people to sign up to volunteer to be a precinct captain, to volunteer to speak for Donald Trump. All of the speakers came on and they emphasized how important it is for people to mark that day on their calendar, January 5th, 7 p.m. Bring friends if you can. Talk to your friends and neighbors about why you're supporting Donald Trump. And I think if anybody has a chance to outperform their polling numbers, it would be Trump because he's drawing these very large audiences and his campaign is really drilling down and trying to get these people to commit to showing up at the caucus and bringing friends. I think that the other thing that I noticed at this rally yesterday is they announced two new legislative endorsements for Donald Trump. That was state senators Kevin Alons and Jeff Taylor. They're from districts up in Northwest Iowa, among the most heavily Republican districts in the country. And I don't think that a lot of caucus goers are taking their cue from what the state legislators are doing. But I do think that legislators who don't endorse early, who wait and see how things are going, I think that they don't tend to jump on a train that they think is on a losing track. So I think that this is a sign that those legislators, they feel that Donald Trump is doing very well in their area, and they wanted to be on board.
And last Saturday, Mike Pence, the former vice president, dropped out of the race for the nomination. He basically played himself as a Trump light and maybe a more compassionate Trump in some ways, but he had no avenue from the get-go.
Well, and I think the only thing that was really surprising was the venue. He was at an event, the Republican Jewish Coalition event. And so I don't think anyone was expecting that kind of a newsworthy announcement there. But Pence was in danger of not qualifying for the next debate. He didn't get a bump out of the previous debates, even though many of the commentators thought he did well. The focus groups and the opinion polls after the debates thought he did poorly. And the bottom line was the people who he thought were his base, the evangelical Christians, they just weren't interested. I mean, he just couldn't gain any traction with that group. That's supposed to be his core demographic. He said that was his goal, was that he was going to be a consistent conservative, that he had been anti-abortion for decades, and he just didn't get anywhere with that. Again, I mean, the electorate is just not that interested. And I thought, I mean, it was timely that he dropped out on Saturday, and then on Sunday, the Trump campaign rolled out a list of 100 pastors or faith leaders who were endorsing Donald Trump.
So the third quarter candidate spending totals came out in Iowa, and the surprise was that it wasn't Trump or Ramaswamy or Nikki Haley or Mike Pence who spent the most money. It was Texas pastor Ryan Binkley. He spent $3.25 million in the third quarter, and this latest poll shows him with 0% support.
Well, okay, I'm going to take issue a little bit with this approach to reporting on these numbers, because what we're seeing in this campaign, which is different from in previous cycles, is that for several of these candidates, their super PACs that are aligned with the campaign are spending far more money than the campaigns are. And also, this reporting was looking specifically at money that was spent in Iowa. And so if somebody was spending money on TV ads, but the ad firm that was doing the media buy was not based in Iowa, or they were doing direct mail, but the direct mail company was not based in Iowa, that was not tallied. So, I mean, we know that several of these campaigns are spending a lot more than the dollar figures given in this article in Iowa. But one thing that it does underscore is that the economic impact of the Iowa caucuses is a lot smaller than what many people assume it will be. And I know David Swenson, a retired economist who taught at Iowa State for many years, he wrote something about this for my website during a previous election cycle, that people overestimate how much the campaigns actually do spend in Iowa. And most of the time, it's not that much.
Let's quickly buzz through these next couple of items. Ron DeSantis called for a Republican presidential debate in Iowa. Of course he would, because he's desperate for any publicity. Governor Reynolds says she's not ready to make a presidential endorsement yet. DeSantis says Reynolds' endorsement would be huge. Right now, Ron DeSantis will look for anything he can get.
Well, I think it's becoming less and less likely that the governor will endorse Ron DeSantis, because if he doesn't look like he's gaining ground, I don't think that she wants to spend her political capital that way. I will say that it would be unusual not to have a televised debate. I mean, even going back to the 1980 caucuses, there has usually been a Republican candidate debate in Iowa not that long before the caucuses. So it would be rather extraordinary for the RNC not to schedule one.
And one quick note, President Biden got a new Democratic challenger this past week, Minnesota Congressman Dean Phillips, who is running primarily on the idea that Joe Biden is simply too old to be president.
That's right. And I mean, and Joe Biden did not file for the primary ballot in New Hampshire, so his name will not actually be on the ballot, but Dean Phillips did. So Dean Phillips defied the Democratic National Committee, which did not include New Hampshire in that spot, given the state laws not being changed. So, I mean, we'll see. I think that it's important to remember that there are always a lot of people in a party who aren't satisfied with the incumbent in some way. And I remember when Terry Branstad was running for re-election as governor in 2014, he had a primary challenger who spent like no money, no events, and he got something like 18% of the primary vote against Terry Branstad. But that didn't mean that those people weren't going to vote for Branstad in November. And I just don't really see Dean Phillips as having a compelling case. I don't think he represents any kind of a constituency or ideological grouping within the Democratic Party. So I'm not really seeing this going anywhere.
One quick note, it was 55 years ago when Eugene McCarthy ran against President Johnson in New Hampshire in the primary. And Eugene McCarthy did not defeat President Johnson. Everybody thinks they remember he defeated him. He did not. But he wounded him enough so that Robert Kennedy got into the race, and that eventually led to President Johnson pulling out of the presidential race at the end of March in 1968.
That's true, yes. But Biden is definitely not in the same kind of position as LBJ. I mean, the Vietnam War was creating a huge strife within the Democratic Party in 1968. And I don't think that there's anything like that kind of issue that has the potential to undercut support for Joe Biden in the Democratic primaries.
Let's quickly get on to what was going on again in Iowa and other areas last week. Governor Reynolds reported on that Iowa mission to Texas. She had sent troops down to the Texas border, and it cost $2 million, and she was there at a news conference to talk about it.
Yeah, so she used federal funding for this from the American Rescue Plan. And she said her argument was that every state is a border state and the federal government isn't doing their job in protecting the border. And so we protected the border. I thought one thing that was interesting about her press conference was that when journalists were asking for details about what are these Iowa National Guard people and the Iowa state troopers going to be doing in Texas, we were told that that is secret, that's confidential, that's not subject to disclosure. And then yet at the press conference, they were giving a lot of details about the number of apprehensions and the amount of drugs that were confiscated and how important it was to be helping Customs and Border Patrol down there. And so in any case, I mean, she didn't mention that she will do this again, but I wouldn't be surprised. The American Rescue Plan money can be spent through 2026. So I wouldn't be surprised if next summer we see another deployment from Iowa down to the southern border.
The governor also got quite passionate in answering a question about books. Many people think the state is trying to ban books. in schools. She denies this, but she had a passionate response saying, "We are way off course. Our kids and teachers deserve better in terms of what they're reading in school."
And then she went on to say they deserve the tools to help these kids succeed, not a damn distraction on a nasty pornographic book that should never, ever be in a classroom. I'm not sure I ever heard her say damn in a public setting before. And to talk about pornographic books, I mean, the law, Senate file 496, does not say pornographic. It doesn't use the word obscene. It talks about age-appropriate materials, and age-appropriate is defined as not including anything depicting a sex act. And that's where the controversy is coming in with this law and school districts seeking further guidance from the state, because there are a lot of classic works of literature that include some reference to a sex act, everything from 1984 to To Kill a Mockingbird. And school districts are looking for guidance on this. And the governor was saying that's overblown. And I think it's very obvious. And everyone knows what this law means.
Just want you to know that Laura has never used the word damn on this broadcast, and I never have until just now, and we rarely talk about sexual acts on this broadcast. So this is a
rarely, yes,
friendly broadcast, Laura. It's family friendly. Damn. All right. Meanwhile, last week came word that the State Board of Education has until December 28th to begin rulemaking process for the new law we were just talking about.
Well, and that's not really that helpful to school districts, because the part of the law that talks about age-appropriate materials in school libraries and classrooms has to be enforced as of January 1st. If any school district or educator is in violation, they could be disciplined. So, I mean, if the rulemaking is not going to be complete, I mean, it doesn't even sound like it's going to be started until December. It certainly won't be complete by that time. And that's not really what the districts are looking for. I mean, school districts have approached this in many different ways. And one of the other areas of the law that's unclear for the districts is that it talks about how you can have no instruction on gender identity and sexual orientation in grades K through six. Well, there are a lot of books written for children that don't include any depiction of a sex act, but they do have LGBTQ characters, or they might refer to the fact that some families have two moms or two dads. And school districts have asked the State Department of Education, is this precluded by the law? And they can't get a clear answer on that. So I think that it is fairly problematic for the districts, because they don't want their administrators or teachers to start getting sanctioned by the State Board of Ed.
The governor also had an update last week on the condition of her husband, Kevin, who was diagnosed with lung cancer last month. He had never smoked. That was a question some of us had. And he had sought treatment only after he thought he had a ruptured disc. Well, he apparently is doing well.
Yes, apparently the treatment that he's receiving is helping with his back pain, which is what originally prompted him to go seek treatment. I mean, one problem, lung cancer is often difficult to detect because people don't always have symptoms in those early stages. And that it sounds like that had been true for the first gentleman as well.
We wish Kevin Reynolds all the best. One more quick note. Navigator, CO2 company, officially withdrew its petition for Iowa for a hazardous liquid pipeline permit last week. It is dead.
Yeah, it is dead. I mean, I think that the writing was on the wall for a long time, especially after they ran into trouble in North and South Dakota. And all signs point to the Iowa Utilities Board favoring the Summit Carbon Solutions pipeline rather than the Navigator one. So now Navigator, as you say, is off the table. The Iowa Utilities Board has yet to finish the hearings. They're going to resume in November the evidentiary hearing in Fort Dodge on the Summit Carbon Solutions proposed CO2 pipeline.
And 45 seconds, Iowa pipeline opponents are suing to block Summit Carbon's water permit for the carbon capture pipeline.
And technically, this is not Summit Carbon Solutions, but it's an LLC that is linked to Summit Carbon Solutions that has sought a water permit. And this will be interesting to see where this litigation goes. The pipeline is going to rely on facilities that should be built next to the ethanol plants that will convert the CO2 into a form that can be transported through a pipeline. But that is going to require a lot of water. So if the opponents of the pipeline can throw a wrench in some of these water permits, that could make it impossible for Summit to complete the project, even if they get approval from the Iowa Utilities Board.
Laura, we're out of time. Do you have enough Halloween candy for Tuesday night?
We do. Yes, thank you.
Good, because I'm coming by about 7:30.
Yeah. Well, here I think people trick or treat in the Des Moines area. It's usually on the October 30th. So we'll see if I have anything left for you tomorrow.
Coming by tomorrow night. That's it. We're out of time for this edition of Capital Week. A reminder that the views and opinions expressed here did not necessarily reflect the opinions of KHOI or its staff. Laura and I will be back here in the same time slot next week, and as usual, we'll talk about everything interesting or important or even entertaining that takes place in Iowa politics. And as always, we hope you can join us. Thank you so much for the privilege of your time. We appreciate it and we value it. Between now and next time, whenever that is, we hope you have a safe, healthy, and happy Halloween week.